This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, Erev Tov, welcome to everybody who's come for this evening lecture, and I'm really delighted that tonight is the launch of a new, our four lecture series. This year we've chosen to organize it thematically, Jewish life, halacha, and our changing reality. This is the first of six evenings that we're going to be holding over the next five weeks, including today, 6 weeks. So I just like to, in the inside of your packet, you will see the whole layout of all of the different lectures. And as you can see, tonight is the inaugural lecture of the series, but please do take a look at the dates and the names of the lecturers. Please, I just want to invite you to all future weeks and to join us as we explore this fascinating topic, which you can see was going to be attacking from all sorts of different directions. So in order that we can to introduce our speaker this evening, I'd like to ask Rabbi Leon Morris, the president of Pardes, to introduce.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for all of your work in organizing this this exciting series. Erev Tov, I'm really delighted tonight to welcome my colleague and friend and teacher, Rabbi Dr. Daniel Hartman. Daniel is, of course, the president of the Shalom Hartman Institute, a major think tank and driver of educational programs for change agents and thought leaders here in Israel and in North America, particularly focused around what is 21st century Judaism. The Machon, established by Daniel's late father, Rabbi David Hartman, who we're proud to say was part of the original faculty of Pardes in 1972, along with other young teachers such as Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz and Professor Eliezer Schweid and Professor Michael Rosenach. When I think of the Talmudic passage that we read in the Tefillah that plays upon the verse from Yeshayahu, Rav Shalom Banaich, and the Talmud says, Al tikre banaich ela bonaich, don't say your builders say your, don't say your sons say your builders. I think of Daniel in, we might say in Daniel's case that he is both a son as well as a builder when we think about the Shalom Hartman Institute. Under Daniel's leadership, the Shalom Hartman Institute has founded numerous educational programs for scholars, educators, rabbis, and lay leaders, which have really been game changers for North America and Israel. I'll give two examples. The Be'eri program of the Shalom Hartman Institute has changed the way that Jewish studies are taught in secular high schools in Israel, Mamlachti high schools in Israel. About one-third of all the secular high schools in Israel use Hartman's curriculum. Their teachers are trained at the Hartman Institute. And it's changed the way that a whole generation of self-identified Chiloni Israelis understand and own their Jewishness. Another from North America is iEngage. This program of the Hartman Institute has changed the way communities throughout North America are thinking about Israel and talking about Israel, Zionism, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Daniel is the author of Putting God Second, How to Save Religion from Itself, as well as a book that is the subject of his doctoral thesis, The Boundaries of Judaism. He's a prominent essayist and blogger and lecturer on issues of Israeli politics, Judaism, and the Jewish community. If it sounds like I am extremely familiar with the work of the Hartman Institute, I had the privilege of working at the Shalom Hartman Institute after making Aliyah and before coming here to Pardes. And there I was a witness to Daniel's rare combination of drive and menschlichkeit, of being a visionary who knows exactly how real programs in the real world take root and flourish. of being equally comfortable in the world of ideas and the world of reality. Daniel is a thinker and a doer. He has the energy level that surpasses the Energizer Bunny, and yet always had time, as someone working for the Machon, always had time to talk, to give advice, and to encourage. In my own leadership of the Pardes Institute, there are numerous qualities of Daniel's leadership that I seek to emulate. Please help me welcome Rabbi Dr. Daniel Hartman.
Very often I've heard people who, after they have that type of introduction, says, "Oh, I feel so bad. I wish my mother was here." My mother's here. So I'm actually doubly happy. See, Ma? So that's very nice. So thank you for that many, many times over. And it's really nice to be in your home. I loved it when you were in our home, but I'm doubly happy that you found this home, and I think you're going to do better things for the Jewish people here than you could have done by us. And so it's a win-win, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak tonight. I want to speak about a subject that I've struggled with my whole life. I've thought about it, and in many ways defines much of my Jewish existence. And that is the question: what do you do when you feel or know that Judaism is wrong? What happens when that's your experience? What happens when you have learned something new? You've discovered something new. You've learned a new truth. You've come to understand a different moral perspective. And your tradition doesn't mirror that. Not only does it not mirror it, it commands against it. What do you do? Where are you in that conversation? Now, you could be an Akedah Jew. You could be. You could say that's okay. That the essence of being Jewish is to transcend your moral commitments. You could do so. But I always knew, and this was a given, and I'm going to come back to some of the assumptions that I'm going to make this evening, I could not be an Akedah Jew. If that's what Judaism meant, and again, depends on how you read the Akedah, obviously, I could not be an Akedah Jew. There were no dilemmas about that. But how do I deal with this question? And the problem is not only not going away, it's getting more severe. Because as time goes on, we're learning new things. Our eyes are opened up. We know the core moral principle, what is hateful unto you, do not do unto others. That principle has been really consistent for a very long time. But who are the others you're supposed to apply that principle to? What's hateful unto you, do not do unto others. L'chavrach, to your chaver. Who is your chaver? Does it include women? Does it include people with different sexual identities? Does it include non-Jews? Does it include heretics? Who is your chaver? And part of what we've been learning is that the parameters of who I should apply that to are changing. And so, my whole life, I've been asking this question. I've been challenged to ask this question. I've been asking it and trying to figure out, how do I find my Judaism? Now, one of the premises of tonight is that I know what it is that I know. I just never assume that that which I know is true. The fact that I don't know it's true doesn't undermine my commitment to that which I know, and even the certainty that I experience when I'm experiencing it as something that I know. I'm going to share with you tonight what it is that I know, knowing fully well that I might be wrong. By the way, any human being who doesn't recognize what I just said is probably an idol worshiper. But that is something I know too. that which they are worshiping is themselves. That a human being could somehow believe that they could attain certainty, that they know, and that they know that which they know is true, I tend to be slightly nervous with such people, but it definitely is not me. I'm not speaking. I want to share with you my reflections, my thoughts, my struggles, and also some of the problematics which I'm fully aware of, and we'll come to that. To what extent, if halakha violates that which you know to be good, what is it that you do? What happens? Now, the first premise of tonight is that Judaism cares about the ethical. That the ethical has legal weight, has religious weight in the decisions that you make. And that the Akedah does not, or one reading of the Akedah, under the assumption that Abraham, when he is challenged and says, Hineni, is in fact willing to offer his son, and that in doing so, God considers that an act of great religious excellence. In fact, that that is the paradigm for how people should live. That position exists within our tradition. More than that, and I gave you some source sheets, but we're going to read some texts from time to time, but most of them are for your own reflection afterwards. Just as a little rule, the first source that I'm going to read is source 3, because I don't want anybody to be able to copy my material. It's confusing. Torat Kohanim, I'm going to read in English because I'm not sure everybody's Hebrew proficiency. Torat Kohanim says very clearly, you shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord your God, am holy, and I have set you apart from other peoples to be mine. If you are set apart from amongst the nations, then you are dedicated to my name. If not, you belong to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and his friends. Please remember this when we're going to see Rambam, Mor Nevuchim 3:31. That the essential dimension of being a Jew is to be Ivri, is to be Me'ever Achad, is to be separated from the world. You're separated emotionally. You're also separated intellectually. What happens there, you have to make a choice. What they know, is that what you know? If what you know and they know, then you're... That's Nebuchadnezzar. When you are only mine. And this is an interpretation of Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha me'artzecha me'modetcha mi'beit avicha la'artz asher eka. The first act that a Jew is asked to do is to walk away, is to break all of their connections, all of their roots. To be a Jew is to be alone. To be a Jew is to be in a perennial ghetto, is to be also, in a certain sense, an intellectual ghetto. Then you're God's. I want complete and total loyalty. As in fact expressed in the Akedah and Avraham's life, or parts of his life. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, from where do we know that a person should not say, I have no desire to wear clothes made of wood and linen. I have no desire to eat the meat of pigs. I have no desire to commit adultery. Rather, a person should say, I desire. This is what I want. But what should I do? My Father in heaven forbids it. I have set you apart from other nations to be mine. From her we learn that anyone who separates themselves from sin accepts upon himself the kingdom of heaven. This is a very strong religious instinct that I understand. I understand it. I respect it. It has no religious attraction to my soul. This religious vision is a spiritual death for me. That I know. This, while a part of Judaism, cannot be the room in which my soul and religious life flourish. Rather, I have different rooms. One of the foundations of my room, of my house, of my life, is that the ethical is critical, and that the motivation to keep the ethical is a critical and essential dimension of what it means to be a Jew. That to be a Jew does not mean to transcend the ethical, to be a Jew does not mean to show your blind devotion to God, but rather that your devotion to God is intimately connected and expressed through the doing of the ethical. Genesis 18 is one of the central verses. When God says, I have chosen them. Why do I choose Abraham? Because he is going to teach his children that to walk in the way of God is to do what is just and right. To walk in the way of God is not to do that which you don't want to do. It's not to do that which is nonsensical. To walk in the way of God is to do that which is good. That's the way. That is the way of God. Tzedek u'mishpat is the way of God. When Hillel has to define all of Judaism, while someone stands on one foot, he doesn't say, fear God. He doesn't say, observe the word of God faithfully. He says, as I mentioned beforehand, man daleich snei lechavrach lo ta'avid. What's hateful unto you, don't do unto others. And then he says, zoi kol ha'Torah kula, v'ashar perushei. Now Hillel knows that this is not kol ha'Torah kula. But he's saying, this is the essence. Any principle of Judaism which violates this ethical principle is outside of the Judaism that he is trying to teach, the Judaism that he's converting this person into. So I am part of my first assumption, and it's an assumption within our tradition, and it's not self-evident, that our tradition is a tradition that cares about the ethical, that the ethical is a part of the worship of God, not outside of the worship of God, not a rebellion against God, not something that you have to transcend, but rather the more you are committed to it, it's precisely there that you find Hashem. The second premise, which is a little more complicated and problematic, even though I believe, again, it is that which I know. And that is, not only is the ethical a core feature of Avodat Hashem, of the worship of God, but that the ethical is independent of God and independent of the tradition. When Euthyphro asks, is something holy, or we translate it as something good because God commands it, or does God command it because it is good? In our tradition, or one of the voices that I get inspired from within our tradition, my assumption in my life and in my remarks this evening, is that a tradition is divine to the extent that it reflects the ethical, and not divine by representing the ethical by definition. A tradition doesn't get to define what is good, but is judged to the extent that it fits and has symmetry with the good which is always independent from it. Our tradition, again, whether this is a possible idea in Judaism or a dominant idea in Judaism, all depends. That's like a little kindergarten, like who's bigger and who wins. But the notion in our tradition of mitzvot she'ilmale nichtavu din hu sheyikatvu, the idea of commandments, if they were not written, they were worthy of being written, that there is a notion of a good which is outside, which obligates our tradition. That same Avraham Avinu, who gets up and says to God, after God says, Yedativ leman asher tzaved banav b'do lalechet b'derech Hashem lasot tzedakah u'mishpat, that that's why I picked him, so that he will do that, then stands up and says to God, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. Avraham doesn't say, God, well, you know, you know what you're doing. Abraham assumes that tzedek u'mishpat, which is the way of God, is something that God has to be committed to just as much as a human being needs to be. And that his job is to make sure not only that his children keep tzedek u'mishpat, but that God keeps tzedek u'mishpat. The mere fact that you make that claim is only possible if you assume that the ethical can be independent of God. If that is outside of your parameters, you can never even make that sentence. You couldn't even ask whether it's a question or make that proclamation. In a more subtle level, look at Hillel's statement again. Mandalaich snei lechavrach lo tavid. And very often we forget one of the more innovative dimensions of Hillel's ethical proclamation. Hillel could have said, "V'havta l'recha kamocha, zoi kol haTorah kula v'ashar perusha hu zil gmor." He could have said, "Love your neighbor as yourself." He could have quoted Leviticus. Here is a convert says, "Teach me all of Torah while I stand on one foot. Give me the essence." He's asking about Torah. Teach a verse from Torah. It's waiting. It's okay. I know we rabbis could make huge sermons about the profound difference between what Havta l'recha kamocha and Mandalaich snei lechavrach lo tavid, and we could move ourselves deeply and really work, get 3-4 Shabbases, maybe even a Kol Nidre speech out of it. It's like it's good stuff. But at the end of the day, if what we had was Havta l'recha kamocha, we would have been just fine. We got the idea. Notice, when Hillel is defining the essential ethical principle of Torah, he doesn't quote a pasuk. He doesn't quote something that comes from within. He doesn't quote the language of the tradition. He doesn't quote a revelation. He quotes a human articulation of the essential notion of good. Ultimately, taken over by Kant, act in such a way, what is the categorical imperative? One of the definitions of the categorical imperative? Act in such a way that you'd be willing for your behavior to be universalizable. Treat others the way you would want to be treated. It's okay. Thank you very, very much. I get excited about these. Because I'm teaching, but I'm talking to you about the story of my life. Talking about the questions and that I've struggled with, and the ways that I found oxygen for my soul. Hillel was oxygen. Genesis 18 is oxygen. So these two premises are critical, and if you have a different premise, I am not arguing against your legitimacy. It's just those aren't the premises of my talk or of my religious life. I'm bearing witness to other premises, to the decisions that I've made, knowing fully well that there are other decisions which lead, as all paths do, to another way, to a different way. A way that's not Jewishly inferior, but a way that's not one that would be applicable for me. Now, when I am assuming this primacy of the ethical, or the centrality of the ethical, and the independence of the ethical, I am speaking explicitly about the ethical. My remarks tonight are about what happens when halakha contradicts the ethical. Frankly, I am not concerned when halakha doesn't make sense. I don't lose any sleep over kitniot. I have to tell you, I know a lot of people talk. First of all, I'm not hungry on Pesach. Baruch Hashem, doing just fine. Managed now, just had my 60th birthday, 60 Pesachs, and I'm still alive and well without kids. Just, you know, I can't even get excited about it. Does it make sense? No. No. I really don't think it makes sense. Should it be overturned? Sure. Will I expend even an iota of energy? No. My commitment to halacha, I recognize the need for a commitment to halacha. I recognize the value of a halachic commitment that doesn't play with the system unnecessarily. And therefore, you know, electricity, shop, I'm not, like, it's just those worlds, I'm fine. Maybe it has to do with the fact that I never learned science. I never had to, because my parents didn't know science. And so I could fail in science because it was science. And that was fine. Like getting a bad mark in science was just being a Hartman. So it could very it was just sort of the coming with the turf, and that was just fine. Like my life was nice. Maybe, again, that's your own personal biography. But I don't mind doing silly things. I can understand tradition. I can understand the value of keeping a tradition. I can understand the price you pay when traditions get opened and changed and bound. I understand it. My issues aren't kitniot. My issue is not whether Shabbat really took into account electricity. Not to believe that there were dinosaurs could be a little problem. Because I don't want to be an idiot. But I could do silly things. But to be a total fool might be a moral problem as well. But by and large, my major question is what happens if the Torah teaches me or demands of me to do something evil that I believe to be evil and morally flawed? And so come with me on a very brief journey through a number of sources. For tonight, I picked primarily the Rambam. He's my Maimonides. And everybody also picks their Maimonides in which chapters they quote, and why should I be any different? The journey begins in 331. Let's open 331. Page 4. There are persons who find it difficult, Rambam says, to give a reason for any of the commandments and consider it right to assume that the commandments and prohibitions have no rational basis whatsoever. They are led to adopt this theory by a certain disease in their soul. The Rambam, while pluralists use him, was not a pluralist. If you didn't agree with the Rambam, you ranged between being an idiot to being deserved of death. And he says that literally. Certain disease in their soul, the existence of which they perceive, but which they are unable to discuss or to describe. For they imagine that these precepts, if they were useful in any respect and were commanded because of their usefulness, would seem to originate in the thought and reason of some intelligent being. But as things which are not objects of reason and serve no purpose, they would undoubtedly be attributed to God. That basically the path of Judaism is a path of doing the absurd, and only through being the absurd do you experience the living with God. And Rambam says you're crazy. You're not, by the way. But he's not, because he's not giving to this opinion its correct, its depth, and its real reading. He's giving it, he's doing something that you're never supposed to do. And that is, you give someone the easiest interpretation for you to reject it, not the interpretation that represents the depth of what it is that this theory is about. And the depth of that theory is that I want to. I'm not looking for reason, because the essential experience of being an Oved Hashem is to transcend my knowledge, to transcend what I care about, and to submit myself completely as an Eved Hashem. But he's saying there's something diseased in their soul. Why? Because, according to the theory of these weak-minded persons, man is more perfect than his creator, for what man says or does has a certain object, whilst the actions of God are different. He commands us to do what is of no use to us and forbids us to do what is harmless. In many ways, while this is not exactly, Leibovitch in Israeli society personified much of that. That this is what defines a religious life. And in Israel in which to be a Zionist entails the willingness to sacrifice your son, the Akedah, and this level of sacrifice as something that's of depth, resonated very, very deeply. A Leibovitchian Judaism fits in Israel in the Middle East, the price that it demands of us. And that hakrava, are you atarezini? Are you willing to lakriv for the country? When someone says that Judaism's seriousness is measured by your willingness to lakriv, it resonated very deeply into the psyche of this country. It's as if our Jewish life is one Altermanian Magasha Kesef. That's the, whatever, if you got. That was very deep. I just moved myself. Okay. But then the Rambam says, far be this. On the contrary, listen very, very carefully. The Rambam is setting here a standard for Judaism that I believe is almost impossible, but he's setting it. The sole object of the law is to benefit us. Thus we explain the scriptural passage, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. God doesn't get up in the morning and say, how could I ruin your life? God doesn't get up in the morning and say, what do you really love? You love your kid? God got it out of God's system. God doesn't need your sacrifice. God is commanding because God loves you, cares for you, and is trying to give you something that you might not know on your own. Again, and he says even further, which shall hear all those statutes, chukim, and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. He thus says that every one of these statutes, even the chukim, which are supposed to be unknown, the ones which we don't know the reasons for, convince all nations of the wisdom and understanding it includes. But if no reason could be found in these statutes, if they produce no advantage, remove no evil, why then should he who believes in them and follows them be considered wise, reasonable, and so excellent as to raise the admiration of all the nations? According to the Rambam, the idea of the divinity of Torah is not measured by your ability to archaeologically prove that Har Sinai happened. The divinity and the truth of Torah is not going to be defined by the archaeological digs of Ir David. The truth of Torah, the divinity of Torah, is determined by its content and by whether a person who sees it says, ah, rak am chacham benavon hagoy hagadol hazeh. Now, who is supposed to say it according to the Rambam? Not somebody, an insider who believes, but an outsider. That the standard, remember the notion that to be a Jew is, are you separated from the world? Then you're by me. If you're a part of that world, you're part of Nebuchadnezzar, according to the Rambam. That world is what defines Torah as God's. It's only when it's not a separation, it's when they see it. And they could say, ah, look at the depth, look at the purpose that the divinity of Torah is proven. The outside world is not my enemy because truth is not a Jewish category. And for the Rambam, as he says, you have to learn how to learn the truth from whoever says it. Now, I think this standard, by the way, is impossible. I don't think you're ever going to be able to achieve a notion that a complete outsider with no inner inclination is going to look at kashrus and say, ah, brilliant. Now, again, I could give a very meaningful lecture to myself about why I keep kosher. I think kosher is just fine. Makes sense. I understand its value. I could teach it. I just don't expect someone committed to lobster to say, you're just brilliant. I just don't expect it. But when it comes to the ethical, I can't expect it. When it comes to the ethical, the notion that an ethical lens, not governed by Jews, not a private internal language, but a universal ethical code, which challenges your tradition and says, do you live up to it or do you not, is a standard that the Jewish tradition can and must live by. But how does it do that? How do you meet this challenge when we know very clearly that for many moral principles, our tradition does not live up to both categories that internally within the Jewish tradition I have come to know to be true, and also ones which people from the outside look at the Jewish tradition and say, it's not that impressive. One of them is the consistent distinction in our tradition between those who are born Jewish and those who are not born Jewish. Now, we love the stranger, that is true. But despite loving the stranger, our tradition allows, permits, and even obligates clear discrimination between Jew and non-Jew. I don't expect a non-Jew, unless that non-Jew is speaking the words written by a Jew along the lines of the Kuzari. You know, I mean, when we tell the Melech what to say, the Melech could be quite impressed with us. But when you actually talk, that and numerous other issues. The Rambam tackles that in Hilchot Avadim. Let's read together. We'll read in English. It is permitted to work a heathen slave. It's on page 9. Thank you, page 5. It is permitted to work a heathen slave with rigor. Befarech. Now the word is very important. Because Ahavta tager ki ger hayita beretz Mitzrayim, the principle that you're supposed to learn from your own suffering and determine, and mandalaych snei lechavrach lo tavid, what's hateful unto you, do not do unto others. Learn from your own suffering, so that should guide you in your conduct towards others. We were worked by Paro with what? Befarach. And the Rambam says, Paro, she says, mutar lavod be'evid knani befarach. You're allowed. The notion of what's hateful unto you, don't do lechavrach, doesn't apply to idolaters, who are basically everybody in the milieu outside of the Jewish people. All of them, knock yourself out. And this is after we know that your brother could, achicha, 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 Leviticus 25, don't do this for your achicha, achicha, aval olam bahem, them. It's a different moral standard. And the Rambam says, he's very honest, and this is a very important part of the journey. Says, I'm not denying that this is what it says. It is permitted to work a heathen slave with rigor. But though such is the rule, it is the quality of piety and the way of wisdom that a man be merciful and pursue justice and not make his yoke heavy upon the slave or distress him, etc. Afal pi shahadin kach midat hachasidut v'derkei chochma. This Rambam is a revolutionary Rambam. He assumes that there is a derech chokhmah and a derech chassidut, which is not contained in Torah. Where does he know it from? Torah commanded it. Why doesn't he say, who am I? If God commanded it, that's what should be. No, the path of piety and of wisdom is not necessarily contained in Torah. Torah permits it. But your responsibility is not to live according to Torah. Your responsibility is to live according to the good. Unless you think that the path of piety and wisdom is just some lifni meshurat hadin for some few special individuals who might want to be machmir on themselves. That's not what the Rambam says. Stay with me. Skip a little bit and check at home that I'm not skipping anything important. Last paragraph. Interestingly, used recently by the Rabbanut in Israel to deny the Jewishness of a person. Their selective use of it is quite interesting, but that's another issue. Cruelty and effrontery are not frequent except with heathens who worship idols. The children of our father Abram, however, the Israelites upon whom the Holy One, blessed be, bestows the favor of the law and laid upon them statutes, are merciful people who have mercy upon all. This is not some unique... If you want to be a Jew, you have to act in accordance with Darkei Chochmah v'Chassidut. That means if you follow the commandment of the Torah according to the Rambam, you're not worthy of being called a Jew. That's not who we are. You think that you get to be Jewish by following the law? If you follow the law, in this case, where it represents a moral principle which is beneath derech ha-chokhmah ba-chassidut, you're acting like them. Zera Avraham, rachmanim hem alakol. And even goes further, it's not in the English, mistakes happen. V'chen b'midotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and in God's attributes, shetzivanu lihidamot bahem, which we are commanded to observe. It says, V'rachamav al kol ma'asav. So ladies and gentlemen, what are you going to do? Are you going to follow Rachamav al kol ma'asav? Are you going to follow Vayikra, which says, V'olam ba'em ta'avodu? You're allowed. But if you want to walk in the way of God, and if you want to be worthy of being called a Jew, you don't follow what Torah says. You follow the moral dictates of the good. Now, it's getting late. And I want to open this briefly in a little bit for questions. But I want to, how is it possible? How do you live with this notion? Because it's a revolutionary notion. It's one thing to say the ethical is independent of Torah. It's another thing to look and to say explicitly within your halachic system, this which the Torah permits is a violation of Torah itself and unworthy for a Jew. It's tough. How do you even keep on opening the book afterwards? What does it even mean? Here too, the Rambam, again, offers us a number of answers. At home, read 225 and 332. Now you know a little bit about my upbringing. People had, in certain families, had jokes by numbers. We had chapters of Mor Nevuchim by numbers. I was just sort of, you said 332. Ah, okay. Joke number four, 225. 225, the Rambam says, and you'll read it at home. And you could email me. 225, the Rambam says, you know, the reason why we believe that the world was created in time, that there was a beginning, Bereshit, is not because it says in the Torah that there was Bereshit. Why would you believe the world was created? It says, not at all. It says the Torah also says that God has a body. And I worked around that just like this. It says, actually, it was far easier. I could interpret Bereshit. I could interpret Genesis 1 in a way that is consistent with Aristotelian ideology or cosmology. No problem. The fact that something is written doesn't limit me. Because according to the Rambam, he continues and says, it is impossible. It is an inner contradiction to state at the same time that the word of God contradicts the truth. Can't be. And therefore, if you think that it contradicts the truth, what you don't understand is what it says. And your job as an interpreter, someone who believes in Torah min ha-shamayim, in the Torah from heaven, your job as an interpreter is to make sure that Torah is worthy of being called divine by ensuring that no aspect of it contradicts the truth. And for us, it's so self-evident that God doesn't have a body. Even the Torah assumes it all the time. The Rambam says, I could have gotten rid of that notion. So the first way, how do you live with this? One way is to psychologically and internally believe that's not what the Torah says. That when the Torah speaks about LGBTQ, even though it didn't know about a Q or a G, it just knew about some. It knew about the. It didn't mean them, it meant someone else. And when the Torah speaks about Ovdei Avodah Zarah, it's not them. It's not people, Shekdurim B'Dagei HaDatot, like as the Meiri, it's not people defined by. It's not what Torah says. And to internally believe that there could be no contradiction, but your guide is not the Pshat of Torah, your guide is the truth that you know. And psychologically, you recognize that it's your obligation to be that type of interpreter. And interpretation is not a revolution against God. It is the ultimate expression of your love and loyalty to God. Because if to walk in the way of God is to do what is just and right, at some times it might mean saying HaShofet Kol Haaretz Lo Yaseh Mishpat, but at other times it means just interpret that this does not apply. This is not what it meant. Psychologically, that's one way in which you live with it. The challenge is that the Rambam in Hilchot Avodah Zarah, in Hilchot Avadim, says explicitly the opposite. The Rambam recognizes that the Torah is flawed and here says it is such. 225 doesn't work for Avadim. Because he says that's what it is. He doesn't say the Torah didn't command it. And those of you who assume that the Torah commanded don't understand what we're talking about. No. For that you need 332. And one of the revolutionary principles of the Rambam is the belief. This is his chapter in Mor Nevuchim on Korbanot, on sacrifices. And the Rambam begins with a lengthy exposition that your body doesn't work this way and the human psyche doesn't work in a way in which you're able to leap from one extreme to another extreme. Everything has to be gradual. Gradual is the only thing that both physically, scientifically, and psychologically is possible. I can't tell you go from here to somewhere else that you've never experienced overnight and think that it's not going to extract a significant psychological price. Everything has to be gradual. And the Rambam says, when the Jewish people in Egypt, if they wanted rain, they offered a goat. You want to get a god to listen to you, you give God a goat. And they grew up thinking that that's the only language that gods understand. And if I would tell you, Jews, don't, no more goats, words. And he hints, no more words, just thoughts. Because in his mind, it's the thought which creates the connection. It's through the intellectual, it's not even tefillah. Says people would, it'd be impossible. I couldn't tell people. I can't tell 14th century BCE Jews to act like 21st century Jews or 13th century Jews. You don't leap. God, while the author of Torah, is not the one who solely defines the content of Torah. The person who hears Torah shapes what it is that God says. And this, while seemingly revolutionary, is really an ABC of any education. I can't, if Dibra Torah Kilshon Bnei Adam is the essential way of expressing it far more explicitly. I have to talk to you. I can't talk to you in my language if you're not capable of hearing it. So the Rambam says a perfect God cannot write a perfect Torah if that Torah is given to an imperfect people. And therefore, the Rambam says, God suffers God suffers sacrifices because an idolatrous people could only speak in language of sacrifice. And God says, knock yourself out. Now, this knock yourself out is actually quite interesting because over half of the 613 commandments are pertaining to sacrifices. And it is a compromise grounded on the lived reality that people are experiencing. God cannot tell you in one generation to have the moral principles and awareness of another. God could push you. God could hint. So the Rambam is basically 332, explains Hilchot Avadim chapter, 9? Even though you're permitted to do so, God is going to speak in moral categories that you could comprehend. Now it's your job to remember that which obligates you is not the moral awareness of a 14th century BCE Jew, but the moral awareness worthy of God, worthy of you as a Jew. One last source, and with this I'll conclude. And then just almost conclude. One of those cases of 14th century moral principles is the inner family dynamic expressed in the laws of Ben Sorel Moreh, the rebellious child. The rebellious child is a child who is a zolel v'soveah, we don't even know what that is exactly, some form of a glutton of something, and doesn't listen to their parents. And that child, according to Torah, the parents are allowed to bring them, or even commanded to bring them to the elders of the gate, and if they judge it and find it to be so, that child is put to death. the Bible in general did not have many healthy family structures. It just didn't seem to work for most biblical figures. That was beyond. One of the purposes of reading Tanakh is to make all of us feel good about our kids and our marriages. It's like I'm not as bad as that. It's like I've made progress. And so Ben Tzoron Morez seems to reflect a very a challenging issue. In the Gemara and Sanhedrin, and with that, let's look at that for a second. There never was in the middle of 7 lines from the bottom. There never has been a stubborn and rebellious son, and there never will be. Why then was the law written? That you may study it and receive an award. This agrees with Rabbi Judah. Alternatively, you may say it was agreed with Rabbi Shimon, for it has been taught. Rabbi Shimon says, because one eats a tartemar, a certain amount of meat, and drinks half a lug of Italian wine, shall his mother and father have him stoned? But it never happened and never will happen. Why then was this law written? That you may study it and receive a reward. The limits of interpretation, our tradition is aware of the fact that they're limitless. We could say, Lo b'shamayim hi. Once Torah is given from Sinai, what it says is dependent on us. When you see Torah as commanding that which is immoral, according to Masechet Sanhedrin, you have a responsibility to say lo haya v'lo nivra. It never was. That means that when you open a Tanakh, when you open a Torah, there are chapters that you're supposed to keep. Certain chapters, haya. Certain chapters, lo haya. How do you know in advance? You don't. You can't tell. It's not written. There is no asterisk. Don't keep this one. How do we know? Because Rabbi Yochanan said, I saw him and sat on his grave. There are people who did Ben Tzoron Morez. It happened. But your challenge as a Jew is whether it is that you are committed to the fact that no aspect of Torah could ever violate the good, or whether you recognize that Torah can violate it, but that you as a Jew, as an Ohev Hashem, cannot violate it. Whether you're 225 or 332. At the end of the day, your job is to ensure the divinity of Torah by ensuring its compatibility with the good, and by saying haya, and by saying lo haya. Now I know that for many, these remarks are very scary. How do you know? I have the power to say lo haya? I could open a chapter. I could look at the Torah's attitudes towards the gay lesbian community and simply say lo haya. I could look at Torah's discrimination or inequality towards women and say lo haya. I could look at Torah's attitudes towards non-Jews and say lo haya. Just like that, lo haya. Then who's going to stop you from shutting the... How do you know? Here I want to come back to what I started my remarks with. I know what it is that I know, but I don't know if that which I know is true. As human beings, we never know. The yearning for certainty is the yearning for that which is beyond us. At the end of the day, you have to do what it is that you know, and do so hopefully with the most decent and with the greatest amount of decency and the greatest amount of integrity. At the end, there will be a God who will look at you and say, did you live a life that was worthy? You want more than that? You want to know? Then all you're going to end up doing is going and finding some rabbi and saying, okay, since I don't know, you know. All you're going to do is creating a myth of certainty by ascribing it to someone else. None of us know. Even if that search for, I want to do what God wants of me, the minute it is not in Shemayim, the minute, as the Gemara and Tmura says, En anachnu rashayim, you're not even allowed to ask. At the end, it's up to you. Are you going to do it right? That's That's our test. Are we going to know in advance? No. To know that you could be doing it wrong is a critical aspect of the checks and balances that you need. But at the end, we have to make sure that the Judaism that we live believes that to walk in the way of God is to do what is just and right. Kitniot, you never eat them. But when it comes to the moral, as an inner aspect of your commitment to God, since God is first, forget my book, halacha has to be second. Thank you. And now, please, should I just take questions? Yeah? Please, sir, and then yourself. I saw those two, and then we'll take the next one. Yes, please. And I'll repeat the question. Right. The question, and I thank you very much for it. Did I understand you correctly that you're saying that on the basis of what you think is good, of your own morality, you could pick and choose? And if that's the case, Torah matiyela, Judaism, what's going to happen? Number one, you are absolutely correct. That is exactly what I'm saying. I want to be very, very clear. On the basis of what you know to be good, you must, I'm not telling you, I don't tell anybody what they should do. In my Jewish life, in this story, my commitment is to a moral good that I have come to understand and that I am religiously obligated as a Jew to pick and choose, not on the basis of what is easy, but to follow that which is in accordance with my notion of the good. And halacha must be second to the notion of the good. Absolutely. What's going to happen from Judaism? Is there going to be one Judaism? There will never be one Judaism. There will also never be one Judaism even if you pick another path. Because even if you say, I won't pick, what does the Torah say? What does it mean? The myth of a singular Judaism was lost a long time. You can never have learned a page of Gemara if you think that we ever... The Shulchan Aruch tries to set up the table for us, and the Rama says, okay, that's good for you, Sashka. Now again, I know that the variety is going to be far more significant. I'm aware of that. But I am far more committed to walking in the way of God by doing what is just and right than by deviating from the way of God in order to create a moral mediocrity which we all ascribe to. I appreciate that there's a price. I know that. And I'm aware of the fact that some people are going to do it wrong. But most people, by the way, nobody's going to listen to my... I know someone says, Daniil, you shouldn't say that. I wish I was so significant that someone would actually start, oh, I heard your speech, I'm going to now pick and choose. Nobody does that. Everybody picks the rabbi who mirrors their opinions anyway, and they're picking... You know, let's be real. Oh, here, no one influences anybody. It's just not... Here, this, though, is a story. This is a story, and now, that's true. The price will be a uniform, actually, the price is not, because we don't even have access to that uniform either, because this rabbi's my authority, and that rabbi's my authority, and that rabbi's my that authority. We have enough things, the diversity could exist even without this. But it is a price. There's a price for everything. The question is, which price you're willing to pay? In my own religious life, that's a price that I'm willing to pay. But you're absolutely correct in your analysis of both what I said and the cost of it. Did you feel I responded? Yes, please, ma'am. Excellent question. Again, one of the potential serious weaknesses, both of you are pointing to serious potential weaknesses in the Judaism that I live in. But here I want to be a little more precise because I think I might have been misunderstood. I was not assuming a uniform, singular notion of the good which transcends time. Here, again, go back to, I really live by, I know what it is that I know, but I don't know whether that which I know is true. I'm not claiming that there is one singular moral truth. There actually is far more consistency, as Michael Walzer argues, than we assumed. That most of the difference is not on the moral principles, but on the application of those principles. Nazis, for example, had the most advanced SPCA in history. They just didn't assume that that Jews were either humans or animals. We were a different. So it's in the application that something that some of the greatest evil could occur. But in the principle itself, there is greater uniformity. But even that, I'm not assuming. I'm not assuming that we're all going to have the same notion of the good. And I'm not even. And I know in my own life, I know how many. I grew up in Yerushalayim of the 70s. You know, where the worst thing that I could possibly. I smoked a cigarette on Purim once. Like, I was really bad. I was pushing the limits. Like, what did I know? You know what I mean? I went to yeshiva from 6:30 in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. Like, what did you know? I've learned. I've changed. I've grown. Could be that for some people I've regressed. My attitudes to gays and lesbians is not what my attitude used to be. I grew up in a world where we didn't know about gender equality, sensitive. We didn't even know about that. We didn't know that words, we knew that words matter, but women, we're nuts. We didn't even know. How many things do you know? I've grown. I'm not assuming that everybody grows with me, and I'm not assuming that my positions now are true and that they apply to everybody. All I'm assuming is that that is what I know. And at that given moment, my responsibility as a Jew is to walk in the way of God by doing what is just and right as I understand it at that moment. And I will be judged. Am I acting according to my moral conscience, or am I acting in accordance with what I think is easy or not easy? And I'm going to be judged, and I have to test myself, and I'm going to be judged by the Rebbeinu Shalom. Am I doing it right? At the end of the day, it's a reverse notion of en la dayan ela ma shein avraot, that a judge only knows what it is that they know. I can only do it. This is who I am. And at that moment, I have to ask, does Judaism fit the standard of 331? Will a person look at it and say, Rakam chacham v'navon hagoy gadol hazeh? Now that am is going to change. And in one generation it might work, and another generation it doesn't. It's not, Jewish life and religious life and working to God is not a relaxed, comfortable existence in which you bask in the certainty given to you by revelation and a limited group of interpreters. It's a life of profound uncertainty in which as a human being, you're struggling. Are you a mensch? At the end of the day, is your Yiddishkeit menschlich? Is it? And are you going to get it? I might be screwing it up all the time. I might be. But I'm trying. And so I know that there isn't one. But I know at any given moment what it is that I know. Do you feel that I respond? Yes. I understood and responded?
Yes,
you absolutely can, please. Yeah, I can. And then the question is, it's like it goes to morality, nuclear. Who's the one who we really should be afraid of? We human beings are just, you know, profoundly mediocre. We are. But a system is not meant to redeem you. There's nothing's going to redeem you from yourself, because that same mediocre person is going to find an even more mediocre rabbi who's going to tell them, go kill this and go do that and go do this. You're at the end. God's greatest frustration is that we never, ever lived up to the expectation that God had of us in Genesis 1. It's just, it's been down. You know, God said, I got a great system. I have the greatest idea. I'm going to create a partner, just like I'm going to create a mini-me. Everybody's fantasy. I'm going to have a mini-me and create you in God's name. It's not who we were. Yetzelev Adam Raminra, welcome to the human story. I'm not creating a system that is more susceptible to those dangers than any other system. We're all susceptible to it. Maybe I'm more aware of it, or I'm admitting it. Okay? Very good question. The question basically is, and you could ask numerous types of forms of it, is, so Daniil, what are your boundaries? What are your boundaries? Now, I'm going to first avoid the question, and then I'm going to answer it. Okay? I'm nothing to any one of you. I'm nobody. Who am I? My mother loves me. My children, grandchildren, my family. I'm not here as your posek. Nobody here anointed me your posek, and none of you are interested in me being such, and I'm not interested in being anybody's posek. I'm a teacher. The interesting question is, if these remarks reflect something that you find compelling, how do you work out your own boundaries? And again, each one of us could work on them differently. I do not believe that interfaith marriage is a moral issue of the same level. I believe it's a different issue. I believe how you treat intermarried couples is a moral issue. How do you treat human beings? How do you treat 2 million people who are right now living in Jewish families, who we could win over because our tradition is a tradition that even an outsider will say, Rakam Chacham V'Navon HaGadol Hazeh. And so if we get over ourselves and get busy and get to work, we have a great opportunity here. I know that half the Jewish people, at least now, are in interfaith marriages. Actually, there are no interfaith marriages. And there's actually no intermarriage in America. Anybody who tells you that there's intermarriage in America is not living in America. Because intermarriage assumes that there are two distinct identities, people with very, very different faiths, who are transcending their faiths. It's not what's happening. An American is marrying an American. Their primary identities are American, and you know, I like to, it's on a multi. So it's not leaving. It doesn't involve the person who in Israel. We still think that intermarriage is assimilation. It's not. All our categories have to change. But I don't believe that a person has an inalienable right to say to the rabbi, regardless of what decisions I make, I want you to marry me. When you speak to rabbis, I have a responsibility to my God too. Now you might, will I go to a wedding? Yeah, I'll go to an intermarriage wedding. I didn't need to have to wait for the conservative Hechsher to do that. I even used to tell families, someone who made the mistake of actually asking me halacha question, I would tell them that you as a grandparent, you're obligated to go because we have to fight for the grandchildren. You don't have the luxury to be insulted. That's not, it's yesterday's story. Like if you wouldn't come, it wouldn't happen. It's not yesterday. Someone who still thinks you could stop it yesterday. You just don't understand. You don't understand the complexity of identity in America. It's a different reality. Our people are an intermarried people. And our Jewish identity is only one part of a far larger spectrum of spheres of identity that we have. And those who are intermarrying are not leaving. They do not see themselves as leaving. And many of those who are marrying see themselves as joining. It's a whole different story. And I do a lot of work with rabbis from all denominations. I can't tell you how many Reform rabbis, they feel that they're being dumped on. Like every one of you are living vicariously off of the decisions that I have to make. But what about me? But I have to make them because I know that if I don't do this, we all know that intermarriage is not a byproduct of the Reform movement. The Reform movement is the only movement that's responding to it. And if you think it's a byproduct of the Reform movement, then you have to believe that the 95% intermarriage rate happening in the former Soviet Union is a byproduct of Chabad. Look, we play this crap. Like this little crap, like my... It's nothing. Of course, Orthodoxy, there is no intermarriage. The fact that 40% of those who are born Orthodox don't stay Orthodox is just simply you've got to leave. So here the rabbi says, I cannot be in it. It's just it's where my community is. Is it what I, but, so there are serious questions. And I don't pontificate against rabbis who intermarry. But I don't believe that you necessarily have a moral right to demand that of me. So that's why because the issue is my moral is a moral principle. There are many people who disagree with me that they think it is a moral issue. Fair, I might come to that point, but again, the most critical thing is not me. I'm irrelevant. Is the question though is a great question because it's how we play, how we think this through. Do you feel I responded? It is my belief, and here again, it's. I know that this many people could obviously disagree that the battle over intermarriage is already lost and that to expend effort to limit intermarriage is to waste our efforts in the North American, not in Israel, it's different in the North American Jewish community outside of Orthodoxy, and that the primary front line is how do we create a community in Judaism that will bring that family inside. That's, now if I have a dollar and I have an hour and I have a teacher and I have an event, it's not on how to get you to stop. You're at another place. It's teaching parents, first of all, don't beat yourself. It's nothing that you, it's just a different, it's a completely different wiring. It's a different system. It's a different notion of identity in which ethnicity and that have a very, very different place. Their Jewishness is different. Once you stop feeling guilty, you don't have to start punishing. And now, how do we create a community that fights for the future of the Jewish people? Here, if I believe in the Maor, in the light of our tradition, I think we can win. That's where I would spend my dollar and my hour. First of all, thank you. And it's the reason why, even if I had a Yetzirah, I don't go into politics. Because I would lose. Again, the job of a teacher is to be a teacher. And you just, and I understand why many people might not like what I've said this evening or what some of my other colleagues say. And I understand it. It represents something that's profoundly frightening. It has inherent risks to it. I'm aware of them. And there is a very deep voice in our tradition that values something different. There is a very deep voice, and I understand its calling. And in that sense, I could understand their rejection. Whether their rejection is menschlich or not, or whether it benefits them or not, that at the end of the day, just as I, at the end of my life, will stand, they're going to have to stand. Those are things, part of what you have to do is you have to just let it go. It's just, there are things beyond you. All you could do is stand up and teach and bear witness to what you know, and whether that helps some people or not, it does. It could get kind of unpleasant, unfortunately. yourself, and then I think yourself, please. Yes. I don't. No, I understand it. It's just not my Judaism. I understand it completely. It's a completely different religious worldview. Genesis 18 and Genesis 22, the story here, I could tell you two different, the story of the tale of two cities. And they're there. And I think Torah doesn't choose. It presents both of them. And one of the interesting things is, just as you said, there are many people, if I'm a Genesis, let's call me a Genesis 18 Jew. If I read what I read, or whatever. For those who are Genesis 22 Jews, they find Genesis 18 completely ludicrous, incoherent. The whole essence of religious life is to free yourself from having to make those decisions, but to follow the word of God. Those who are Genesis 18 Jews look at Genesis 22 Jews and say, no, that's not what it meant, and we all have all the... And the biggest problem is they can't read the end of the story. They all say, no, that's what God didn't mean, God didn't want, then why does it say at the end? Because of this, it says it. So, but they can't see it either. And maybe our tradition is telling us that we should stop trying to convince each other, but we could recognize that our tradition has different voices. And the question that each one of us to ask is, which chapter is the one that enables you to breathe? And so I read Genesis 22. I hear it. It's just not the chapter within which I build my Jewish life. Is that a sufficient enough response? I can't. And because, like, if you would have said the Akedah, I could. But when you pointed to the end, for years I've been arguing all those who are whitewashing the Akedah story aren't reading the end. And so once you quoted the end, I can't tell that to you. So that's the best I could do. Last question or comment for tonight. Yes, please, sir. Great. Excellent, excellent question. And again, I think as most of the questions, each one of the questions points to, yes. First he started with, what was your name, sir? Leslie, with an extensive compliment, but I won't repeat that out of humility. But the question was, Daniel, I understand you when you're talking as an individual. But the lecture is about halakha. Isn't halakha a system for a collective, which requires authorities? And it's not, if you say this is what you want to do as an individual, but does it mean that halakha, could you as an individual is halakha beyond you? Isn't halakha the domain of the community, not the domain of the individual? And there, you have to pick individuals who will make those decisions for you. Did I represent the question well? Okay? And again, just like all of them, these are the weak points. These are the vulnerabilities of my argument. Of the position, and I'm aware of them, and here I have to give another assumption. I didn't give an assumption about halakha. That assumption is that the Jewish community does not have a singular halakha, is not obligated to have a singular halakha, and that the whole, like if you look at the most halakha is not written in the Rambam, Torah, the Shulchan Aruch. Most halakha is written where? In Shutim, in Shelot v'Tshuvot, in the responsa. That is where the vast majority of halakha is written. And if you actually spend time reading, and I'm sure you've done, if you read responsa, you'll see that the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch could be quoted, but usually it's just one small part of a journey that begins somewhere else. Responsa, the authority, give my regards, no, the authority of a person who writes Shutim, responsa, no one is appointed to the position of writing responsa. You write responsa when there is a community that listens to you, and another community does not. So Moshe Feinstein, for example, was known. Why was so many people from so wide, broad spectrums willing to turn to Moshe Feinstein? And part of my PhD was on Igros Moshe, was because they knew that when Moshe Feinstein writes, he starts by seeing the person who's asking the question to them. I went to a yeshiva with a person who was a huge, huge Talmid Chacham, who no one ever turned to him for a psak. You don't want to turn to him for a psak. He wasn't a person, because he actually felt the Akedah was, you know, like, you weren't worried, like, it was like, he is, like, Akedah was very important to him, and he, you know, when you're turning to someone for a psak, you're not looking for someone to say, die. You know, you want that, or kill yourself, it's like, you want, so who is a posek is very rarely measured on the basis of how much you know, but on your basis, on the ability to see people, to talk with people. That was Rav Avadya Yosef's, you know, all the Ashkenazim could be, oh, he wasn't the greatest Talmid, he didn't have the creativity, he just remembered. But when he writes, he wrote, and that's why his books were, it was so broad, because you spoke to me. The power of a posek is not determined by a government, chas v'shalom, not determined. It's not determined by a group of, we don't have that Sanhedrin, whether we ever had it or for how long we had it. Judaism has grown with poskim who speak in a language, and their authority grows from a community who's willing to listen. And so, ultimately, there are multiple communities, multiple, in which you find yourself. Very rarely are you alone. And I'm not, and I think part of what you're challenging is, I'm not recommending that you are completely alone. If you're the only one in the world who understands something, chances are you don't understand it. And it's something very, very healthy to make sure to talk to, you find this, to talk to people, to share, to struggle with something, to see who else thinks a certain way. Not the minute, oops, I know this now, tomorrow I know. It's a little more complicated process. You have your communities. Now, my PhD I wrote on, and I'm not going there. I'm not that type of rabbi, but we're finishing in 2 minutes. But on the boundaries of Judaism. What are the boundaries? Looking at what are the primary boundary categories of Mishumad, Min, Kofer, and Apikoros, which are the four primary ways in which we spoke about people who are beyond. And I studied the way, how did Chazal create boundaries? How did the Rambam, the Poskei Yemei Binayim, Rambam Tor Shulchan Aruch, use these categories, and how ultimately, in response to the revolution and ovation of the Reform movement, how did the Chatam Sofer at the beginning and Moshe Feinstein at the end deal with these issues of boundaries? And one of the issues is to recognize that we're not going to have a community who agrees. Can we have a community which doesn't agree on what we do, but agrees on the lines, on certain lines that we don't cross? Now, we're all going to cross each other's lines, but are there certain lines that you can't cross? And one of the things that Chazal created, and it's just worthy, again, I'm Jewish because it's like, there's nothing like Chazal. And in the care that they used on this category, when they said that as long as you believe that Torah applies to you, and as long as you believe that you are part of Am Yisrael, you're not beyond the pale. We're not going to have Jews who agree on halakha. We're going to have multiple communities with different halakhas. But as long as we're all striving to make the Jewish people strong, and as long as we're all striving to find a way to live within our Jewish life, I'm okay with those multiple communities. And again, that's what we've always had. I would love for there to be multiple communities, not merely on the basis of whether you eat kitniot or you don't eat kitniot, but on the basis of some of the central moral challenges that we face. And that if a decentralized halakha is the consequence, is the correct consequence of what I'm saying, the fact that halakha applies to you, not as a single individual, but as whatever community you belong to, that responsibility to live to that according to that voice which challenges you to do the good, build your sub-communities around it. And then when different communities argue over what is the meaning of that good, what are its consequences, when we have that machloket l'shem shamayim, sofa lehitkayem, and I think the Jewish people will be stronger. Please remember this one line: difference doesn't undermine collective identity. How you respond to difference undermines our collective identity. Thank you all very, very much.
Daniel, I want to thank you for launching this series in such a challenging, with such a challenging and engaging lecture. Thank you all for coming. Please join us next week for Rabbi Shlomo Brody.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.